Hey, Greg, I just want to say I loved the episode with Robert Morningwood. Probably the best episode. I think I've listened to most of them. Need to get that guy on again and do about a 6-hour episode. I'll listen to the whole damn thing. Thanks. Bye.
In the 1930s, President Franklin Delano Roosevelt addressed the nation through a series of radio broadcasts known as the Fireside Chats. His aim was to reassure the common man that our society would recover from its troubled times. But we're far from 1930, and I deal with a different kind of fire. For a new era of worldly frustration, we offer a fresh conversation. I'm Greg Carlwood, and these are the Fireside Chats.
Hallelujah, Higher Side Chatters. We are back in the saddle, drinking my drink, smoking my smoke from sunny San Diego. I'm Greg Carlwood, and I am so psyched to finally be launching THC Plus with this show. So people who have subscribed for $5 a month will be able to hear 2 hours today at thehighersidechatsplus.com. And thanks so much for helping me out, by the way. And if you're listening through traditional means, the free show will be a one-hour show. But this is a great one to launch with. Nick Redfern, the amazing author and researcher that I'm sure all of you know, is here. And today, every conspiracy we talk about involves either some missing files or strange deaths. And these are two factors that oftentimes are missed because the files or the people don't go missing, sometimes until years after the events, or while the shadowy puppet masters are out there doing some cleanup that nobody's paying attention to. Some of these cases we talk about are really new to me and are pretty interesting, and some of the conspiracies we talk about are pretty legendary also. But even on something like Roswell, even though I've heard the story 1,000 times, I still wonder if it's a real space alien story. Of course I lean towards yes, but it can't really be proven at this point. That said, when you hear about files that have been taken or destroyed and a series of witness deaths and stuff that can be proven, it forms a stronger and stronger case, and that's what this episode is largely about, and both hours contain some great stories. Wilhelm Reich, Marilyn Monroe, and Aleister Crowley, oh my. I also want to throw out there that I'm looking for more theme songs and more independent artists and bands that want to hear their own music on THC outros, so I'm trying to set up an archive to use and avoid copywritten music, because a show of this nature specifically really shouldn't have such a huge vulnerability like that. And so we're going to fight the system by making our own archive of usable music by the artists and fans that like the show. So you can read more about it at thehighersidechats.com/music, or you could just submit your own tunes to the show via email at mymusiconthc@gmail.com. And if we get a lot of music in there, you know, we have a lot of fans that have submitted stuff over the years. It just gets so convoluted with all the emails I get. I miss things, I lose things, but having it all at this email, having only this email dedicated to accepting song submissions, it's going to make it so much easier. And if it gets bigger, I see no reason why we shouldn't open it up to other shows. Because putting such huge prices on mainstream copywritten music is just a system to ensure that huge networks and companies like Sony Music, Universal, Paramount, these companies have access to things we independent artists don't have access to and can't get access to. And it's clearly the most popular, well-produced music available. So that puts a ceiling on independent artists in the same way that a large amount of regulations and red tapes and liquor licenses keep people from being able to open restaurants and compete with the big boys and the big chains that have already solved those problems nationwide. So I don't like that shit, so I'm going to try to circumvent it, and I hope you're with me, and I hope the artists out there also appreciate the chance to be on a national, global stage, and it doesn't cost them anything. I think it's a win-win. So let's do the damn thing. The money bomb is still growing strong. If you want to hear the extended show and haven't signed up yet, please go to thehighersidechatsplus.com. It supports me, keeps a roof over my head, and keeps the good times flowing. But let's just get down to it and dive right into a ocean of weirdness and a sea of strange coincidence with Nick Redfern.
When I find myself in times of trouble, Mr. Carlwood comes to me speaking words of wisdom, THC.
All right, folks, as you well know, when we're talking about things like extraterrestrial contact, high-profile assassinations, and secret mind control programs, you get many different perspectives and angles to these stories, and it's very hard to get any type of absolute proof. Add in the fact that the keepers of these secrets actively employ disinformation agents to throw us off the scent, and it makes you wonder if we'll ever know the truth. Well, today's guest, the returning champion of THC appearances, is Nick Redfern, the author and investigator very well known for his level-headed approach to fringe research in subjects like cryptozoology, UFOs, and government secrets. He's released two books since his last appearance on the show, For Nobody's Eyes Only, Missing Government Files and Hidden Archives that Document the Truth Behind the Most Enduring Conspiracy Theories, and Close Encounters of the Fatal Kind, Suspicious Deaths, Mysterious Murders, and Bizarre Disappearances in UFO History. We're about to talk about both of them today. Lots of interesting info contained within those pages. I know I'm psyched to have him here. The ladies love him. The guys want to be him. Nick Redfern, my man, how the hell are you?
Hey, Greg. Doing good, thanks. Doing all right?
Yeah, man.
Good.
It is great to have you back. I really enjoy both of these books. I initially thought they were going to be very different, but the commonality that I think is so important is that you're looking at some of these major UFO and conspiracy events with a wider scope and looking to see if there's been either some strange deaths associated with events or evidence that has been deleted or removed files. And those are huge indications that there's more to some of these stories than the cover stories would suggest. Is that kind of the approach you had in mind?
Yeah, well, when I'm writing any book, I guess, you want to be able to bring something new to the reader. You know, if they're going to go out and spend $15 on a book, you want to be able to provide something new. And, of course, people say, well, what could be said new about, say, Roswell, for example? You know, hasn't it already been said? Well, it sort of depends on how you look into it, how you dig into it. And that's why with For Nobody's Eyes Only, instead of just doing an overview of the case, I did a study. The chapter in that book is a study of how we can prove that certain files on the case and certain files from the Roswell base from that crucial period of 47 have gone. And then in the new book, Close Encounters of the Fatal Kind, that deals with, again, not an overview of the case, but a study of people who died under mysterious circumstances in connection with the case. So that's what I always try and do, whatever the subject is. Even if it's an old subject, you try and bring something new and sort of worthwhile to the reader.
Yeah, man, and you do a great job. I mean, you write more books than anyone I know. That's why we've had you on so many times. You've always got new material, and it can be challenging probably to find new angles, but I mean, you do a great job. I'm surprised there's actually so much crossover and subjects between the two books, because many of these topics have dead bodies and missing documents, which is kind of funny.
Yeah. Well, a lot of it is, I kind of take sort of the same approach. My background is sort of in regular journalism, so I tend to sort of take the same approach to investigating Roswell or Rendlesham Forest or whatever as I would any kind of story. You know, if it was a local murder or, you know, a fraud case that a magazine or a newspaper wanted me to cover that, I sort of use the same techniques. And I think if you sort of go looking, and instead of just, you know, just relying on the internet or whatever, and you think, you know, it's all there because, well, it's on the internet, so it's obviously all there, you know, provided you don't take that approach, then it actually isn't difficult to come up with other information. It just means you've got to sort of be persistent.
Yeah, I get that. And, well, let's go ahead and dive into some of this stuff, man. I think Roswell is a great place to start because it pops up in both books, and you've uncovered several interesting side plots to the Roswell saga, and it contains a combo of strange deaths and missing files. But let's start with the sexy stuff, the strange deaths. One that I thought was pretty interesting was the story of Glenn Davis and his mystery nurse. Can you tell us about how that unfolded?
Yeah, well, there's a lot of people over the years have come forward with varying accounts in relation to what happened at Roswell, and many of them didn't come forward until sort of literally decades later. I mean, Roswell was 47. Some of these people didn't come forward till like 87, 88, sort of 40 years after, when even if they were only sort of mid-20s then, they were sort of pushing 70 by, you know, as the 80s sort of got further and further along. Well, one of these people was a guy named Glenn Dennis, and Glenn Dennis was actually the mortuary assistant at the Ballard Funeral Home in the town of Roswell in the summer of 47. And he got this weird phone call out of the blue from the base asking if he got any small caskets, child-sized caskets, and they were after like four or five of them. And he clearly realized, you know, this isn't something in like a little sleepy town as it was back then, aside from the base. That's not the sort of thing you hear every day.
Yeah.
So he realized something unusual had happened. And so what Glenn Dennis did, he drove out to the base and he said there was all sorts of stuff going on and people running around and clearly something major was going down. Well, when he was stopped and said, you know, I got a call, I'm the mortuary assistant, they let him through. You know, they assumed that somebody had called him to the base, which actually wasn't the case. He'd just gone there on his own volition, so to speak. And when he got there, he met a nurse of his, a friend of his, who was a nurse at the base, and she ushered him into like one side and said, you know, you've got to get out. And she basically confided him the bones of the story, which was that some strange bodies had been found in the desert, small humanoid bodies. Nobody knew what they were, even where they were from. All they knew was that like a large field of wreckage had been found and these small bodies, and that's really all they knew. So they brought the bodies in for study, and she told Glenn Dennis that, you know, you've got to get out of here. Now, Glenn Dennis did tell a few friends about this who've since come forward, and they've confirmed that he told them sort of 48, 49, but then he went totally quiet and said nothing until 89. And it was in 1989 that Glenn Dennis finally decided to speak out and confided in a couple of UFO researchers. And what happened was that the story then sort of got bigger and bigger. And Glenn Dennis didn't want to reveal the nurse's name. He wanted his story out because he felt it was important and he wanted people to know how he got the story. But he sort of obfuscated and sort of skirted around the edges when people asked for her real name. But he used a pseudonym for her of Naomi Self. And he said, well, when people asked, is that her real name? He kind of said, well, it's up to you to look into it, that kind of thing. And over the years, because he didn't reveal the name, it became hard to figure out who it was. Well, the family of a woman named Miriam Bush, who wasn't a nurse at the base, but she actually did hold a major medical position at the base. She was executive secretary at the base hospital. And she, her family have actually gone on the record as stating that literally right days after Roswell occurred, she told her family the story about seeing these strange bodies and they're brought in and she got to see everything and they were sort of horrible and terrifying to look at. And almost certainly, Miriam Bush was Naomi Self, the pseudonym that Glenn Dennis created. Now, it turns out that apparently a lot of the people who were on site at Roswell, and were not just the guys who sort of went out days later and picked the wreckage up, but the ones who really were exposed to pretty much the full picture, like Miriam Bush, she'd sort of descended into a psychological collapse where she had like a nervous breakdown. She became very stressed, became very paranoid, and probably with a lot of reason that she was being watched and followed, and she descended into like complete alcoholism. And by 1989, when Glenn Dennis surfaced, she was in her late 60s then. And she actually told her family that she thought someone was watching her even more now. She didn't really elaborate on why, but she was sure that somebody was either trying to find her or track her down, as if, you know, they'd lost track of her over the years,
mm-hmm.
and that her life was in danger. Well, on one particular day in late 1989, she checked into a hotel, or a motel, excuse me, funnily enough, under her sister's name and address, and she was actually found the next morning dead in the hotel room with a plastic bag over her head and bruises on her arms. And her family have actually spoken out, stating that, you know, they felt there was something suspicious about this. And what's intriguing is that she killed herself just before the end of 1989, or was killed, I should say. And Glenn Dennis only went public with his story about 3 months earlier. So, in other words, he went public with the story, but not the name. And it was right around that time that then she said that this sort of surveillance and angle of somebody trying to find her really increased big time. And I think somebody knew that she was possibly one of the last people left who could really blow the lid on the whole thing. You know, not just guys picking up strange wreckage in the desert where, you know, the government could say, well, it was just weather balloon materials, but somebody who actually was a very credible person and who could say, yes, I saw the bodies and this is what they were like. So her death is sort of very, very suspicious one.
Yeah, I would say so. I mean, she's a prime candidate. She has a medical background. She saw the bodies. Yeah, that would be a problem for people who wanted to keep this stuff a secret. But just like her, there were a lot of people involved that seemed to have long-term alcohol abuse problems, eating disorders, mental breakdowns, seemed to be a lot of stress-induced people who only saw apparently a weather balloon, right?
Well, yeah, I mean, another one of the ones who died, not necessarily suspiciously in the sense of being murdered, but just suspiciously, based on what you said, that if it was just a weather balloon, it wouldn't have happened, was the rancher's son. The rancher, Matt Brazel, who worked the Foster Ranch in Lincoln County, where the wreckage and reportedly the bodies was found. He had a son named Vern Brazel. And at the time of the crash, Vern was only like 8 years old, but he used to help his dad on the ranch. You know, he used to enjoy sort of going around and rounding up the cattle or the sheep or whatever. And he apparently, the rumor is that he and his dad actually stumbled upon not just the wreckage, but possibly one or more decomposing bodies in the desert. And it had a majorly traumatic effect, actually, on both of them, you know, which is not surprising. And so the story is that it sort of very psychologically affected him. And when he became legally old enough, he actually left New Mexico, Roswell, behind him, traveled around a little bit, almost like in a on the road, so to speak, ended up in California and blew his brains out with a pistol when he was just like 23.
Huh.
And again, we'll probably never really know the full story behind Vern, but I mean, he does sound like somebody who was sort of psychologically scarred. Another one was another person who also sort of descended into the whole angle of alcoholism as well. And again, this just sort of demonstrates it wasn't just one person. This was a guy named Dee Proctor, who again was just young at the age of at the time of the event, and again sort of plunged into a state where he developed alcoholism and also an eating disorder, and died at a young and tragic age, and, you know, essentially became like a hermit, refusing to talk about anything to do with the crash, and sort of lived a almost like a paranoid, fear-filled life as well.
Yeah, there's a long list of those. It's pretty compelling anecdotal evidence that something serious happened. But another aspect that shows that the weather balloon cover story is probably a bit flimsy comes from the book of missing files and the story of Congressman Stephen Schiff, who he did exactly what I would want to do if I was elected to office, which is try to unearth some dirt on the Roswell crash. But tell us a little bit about his story and his trouble with trying to find the files.
Yeah, well, sure. Well, Stephen Schiff, you make a good point there. He could do what nobody in the UFO field can do. You know, he was a congressman. He had the ability to open doors and push people and influence people and so on. And one of the things he did, because he was a congressman from New Mexico, he had a lot of constituents who said, you know, my grandfather was involved in this incident and was threatened and silenced, or even some of the old-timers themselves told him, look, you know, this is what we saw. And we want to put the record straight because we're retired military people and we're ending up looking stupid or whatever. And so what Congressman Schmidt did, he approached what today is called the Government Accountability Office, but back in 1994 was called the General Accounting Office. And the GAO is a very powerful organization. It literally has the ability to essentially knock on the door of any government agency and say, we want to see your files on this subject or that subject to see if there's been proper rules and regulations and accountability followed. And so what the GAO did, it wasn't so much an investigation of the crash, but it was more any files you've got, you will hand over to us for review, and we will see if proper rules and regulations are followed. Now, every agency of government report, apart from the FBI, who found a one-page document, which had been in the public domain for years anyway, and which talked about the weather balloon theory and the idea, the story that something was being transferred to another base for study, but it wasn't, you know, there was no smoking gun there. And other than that, nothing surfaced from the FBI, the Air Force, CIA, nobody. They all came back totally blank. Now, the Air Force, interestingly enough, did make one, I want to call it a discovery, because if you discover something, you find something. What actually happened was that they found that there was something missing. And what was missing was a massive files covering the key period in question, and also a year or two before and after, of all the outgoing messages from the Roswell Army Air Force base from that period are just gone. And they're still gone to this day. They cannot be found. And yeah. On top of that, a bunch of other files are missing as well. Now, the Air Force, in the wake of the GAO investigation, which essentially turned up nothing, as the Air Force put out their own report, and they came to the conclusion that what was found was something called a Mogul balloon. Mogul balloons were, it was part of a classified balloon-based operation back then, and the idea was to launch these huge balloon arrays, which would monitor for early atomic bomb detonations by the Soviet Union. In other words, they go high in the atmosphere, and they could monitor for like radiation atomic tests by the Soviets. And the Air Force concluded that is what the Roswell event was. Now, a lot of people sort of point the finger at the Air Force and call them the bad guys and say they were outright lying about the Mogul theory, and also a second theory that the bodies were crash test dummies used in parachute experiments. I kind of take a little bit of a different approach, and this is something that is like a theme that runs through the book. I truly don't believe that the Air Force are the bad guys when it comes to Roswell. What I think is that when the GAO went knocking on every door, the Air Force felt, because it was, we know it was the Air Force that handled the case back in the 40s, they felt the onus and responsibility was on them to find the answers, because if anybody should know, the Air Force should. Now, when the Air Force went looking and couldn't find anything, I still think they felt the responsibility was on them to at least try and come up with an explanation. And I think that's why they came up with the Mogul balloon one, because from their perspective, it fitted at least some of the facts. Now, I think there's enough data to suggest it wasn't a Mogul balloon, but some researchers then, you know, they're like, oh, well, it's the big bad Air Force lying to us. What I think is that probably at some point in the 50s or 60s, but certainly no later, the really deep UFO program was sort of taken out the hands of government and the military and was handed over to very powerful sort of private corporations with multinational links and old money and power players. And, you know, that's not to say they're hiding underground. They're almost like hiding in plain sight. But I think that today's Air Force probably may not know hardly any more than we do about Roswell. They may have suspicions and fragments of stories, but I don't think they're the bad guys hiding from Schmidt, Congressman Schmidt, what happened. I think they went looking, found nothing. And we have to remember, it was the Air Force who pointed out that all the records had gone. I think if they were the ones engaging the conspiracy, they would hardly have said, well, all the records have vanished. You know, that just makes it look even more suspicious. So I think we've got like a shadow government or a shadow agency that is overseeing all this. And the people we assume are hiding the truth, like the Pentagon and the Air Force, you know, they could be sitting now on a lunch break, a coffee break at the Pentagon saying, yeah, we really don't know what happened, but everybody thinks we do. And I think that's how the secret's being kept, because the government aren't the bad guys, the Air Force aren't, the CIA isn't. It is really this sort of shadow group that operates outside the law, outside of congressional oversight, that isn't really a part of government. It really is like its own unique entity. But the difficult thing is the concept of wrapping your head around that scenario. How could that happen, that there could be a government within or without a government? But I think that's really what there is.
Oh, I think there's plenty of evidence to suggest that there is a group that is just designed to be cleaners of these type of activities. I mean, the Men in Black seem to be a part of this, but yeah, there seems to be quite a bit of evidence that if not sectors of these military or alphabet agencies, then maybe there's a separate one that just cleans up all the messes as they happen globally.
Yeah, and I think also that it's not just that there's a shadow agency that cleans up things, but I think, you know, people, if you look back to the 40s and 50s, we have a lot of reports about alien bodies being seen by military personnel in sort of like cryogenic storage or in formaldehyde or something like that, preserved and stored away. Those stories kind of tail off, interestingly enough, for the most part, by the time the 70s came around. And so, again, that's why I think we're dealing with like a shadow group. You know, I don't think it's a coincidence that most of those reports have tailed off and nobody really sees those bodies again at like Wright-Patterson, which is one of the main places in the 40s and 50s where, you know, a lot of people came forward. So that's why I think the bodies and so on and the wreckage are probably held by, you know, very powerful corporations and industries that do sort of defense contract work, you know, developing new aircraft systems, weapon systems. And I really think it's been farmed out to them. You know, I don't think there are like formaldehyde bodies of aliens preserved under the Pentagon. But if you ask me, a private corporation that develops new propulsion systems for spacecraft or that does viral research and biological research, that's probably where the bodies are held today. And again, that's why we don't find them, because they're no longer held at the military bases or whatever. Again, it's some sort of flexible secret agency outside of government, but with networks and links all around the planet. But it's so powerful that it is like a government, but it's not viewable in plain sight, if you like.
Yeah, I think that makes a lot more sense too. And you also write a little bit about missing documents pertaining to Philip Corso, who was a pretty explosive Roswell whistleblower. For the people who might need a refresher, remind us of his story and what you found interesting about his FBI files before they were suspiciously omitted from the new archive.
Yeah, well Philip, Lieutenant Colonel Philip Corso, or I should say American lieutenant. That was my English accent then. But Lieutenant Philip Corso was the author of the book with Bill Burns of The Day After Roswell. And Corso had a very controversial story. He claimed that he was involved in a program to essentially seed the alien technology from Roswell into the U.S. science, technological, and defense industries to try and further the U.S. military's technological power. You know, if you could introduce alien technology and we could understand it, that would give you a major kickstart on everybody else on the planet. So that was basically the theme of the book. And, you know, it must be said, and as I point out in my book, In For Nobody's Eyes Only, that there are people who support Corso's story just as much as there are people who don't support it. And it's one of these that sort of polarized the field of UFO research. But what's interesting is that there's an FBI file on Corso. And the FBI loaded it up to their website something like about 10, 7, 8 years ago, something like that. And it gives a lot of background on what Hoover thought about Corso and his military background and things like this. Now, just a couple of years later, the FBI created a new website called The Vault, which is a really good website, which I recommend to anyone that's interested in the history of the FBI's involvement in all manner of things. You can find files on, for example, the early years of gangsters like Bonnie and Clyde and operations to arrest German spies in the Second World War and Soviet spies at the height of the Cold War. And it's a really fascinating website, very historical, and you know, the FBI have done a great job of uploading all these files in PDF format, and you can download them all for free. But what's interesting and intriguing is that when there was this transfer from the old website to the new one, yes, a lot of the files got transferred, but a number of files, interestingly enough, on people in the UFO subject, didn't get transferred. for example, if we have a courthouse file, you can still get it. But for some weird reason, it didn't make the transfer from website to website when so nearly like 97-98% of the others did.
Mm-hmm.
Another person who was heavily involved in ufology and whose file didn't make the transfer was somebody who, I guess more than anything else, has become known for his research into the field of cloud busting, as it's known. Now, cloud busting essentially is the ability to affect the weather and change the weather. And certainly the one person who more than any other was, I guess, a leading early proponent and pioneer in this field was Dr. Wilhelm Reich. Now, Reich had an extensive FBI file. It runs to like nearly 1,000 pages. And that was on file at the old website, but that didn't make it to the new one either. And Reich was someone who also was heavily involved in studying the UFO phenomenon. So, you know, there are a couple of cases like that where files, we can still get them through the Freedom of Information Act. They're not denied. It's just they're not profiled online anymore, which, you know, obviously makes it difficult for a lot of people to know they even exist.
Yeah, Reich is an interesting guy. He actually, from what I understand, thought that Cloudbuster gun could also fight UFOs, and he thought that the good and bad entities had different propulsion systems, something like that.
Yeah, well, Wilhelm Reich was a very sort of fascinating character, a fringe scientist who was very much ahead of his time. He felt, number one, that the weather could be manipulated. He created these technologies called Cloudbusters, which essentially could alter the weather. But he also had a fascination with something that he called orgone energy. And he believed that orgone energy was sort of like the primordial life force energy that essentially was the engine behind the entire universe and everything in it. And he believed that this energy was being sort of adapted and used by what he called, essentially good and bad UFO entities. In other words, energy that could be utilized as a power source, as a weapon, as an energy. And he felt that this one particular form of orgone energy, the sort of the positive one, could be used against these negative entities. And he claimed that on a number of occasions, he literally kind of entered into like a War of the Worlds scenario where he would be able to tell where UFOs were in the skies of like the Southwest desert areas, and he could blast them with this positive orgone energy, you know, almost like I said, like H.G. Wells' War of the Worlds. And but he died in prison, sort of a broken man, and all his scientific papers were destroyed, and a very weird story.
Yeah, it sounds so odd, but for a guy who was a player at that level, I mean, obviously he was a smart, intelligent man. I mean, who am I to say that he can't do this kind of stuff with that argon energy? You know, it's kind of crazy. But he also felt like he was set up, was what put him in prison, right?
Well, yeah, I mean, the thing is with Reich, as I said, there were a lot of weird aspects to his story. Now, one of the strangest ones of all was that this issue of what it was that put him in prison. And it's sort of, I won't say it's totally unique, because it wasn't totally unique, but it was one of these situations where it sort of did raise eyebrows. Now, what happened was that he was essentially jailed for refusing to come to court or to go to court on what were called interstate commerce and fraud charges. Basically, all he was doing was traveling across state lines with his technology in the back of his big truck. But because he sold this technology or technologies to people who might want to buy it, and that included his books, that was perceived as interstate commerce and fraud charges. Mm-hmm. And the reason for the fraud angle was because officially it was disputed that his ideas had any validity to them. So in other words, denying their validity, that was perceived as fraud. You know, he was writing books, and because the scenario was, well, there's nothing to this, then it's got to be fraud. And then when he's traveling across state lines, that's when you have this other angle come in. So, you know, that in itself is what got him in trouble. And then, admittedly, part of it was his own fault by refusing to actually, attend the hearing and so on. And then, so he got arrested and ended up in jail. And so part of his sentence was the fact that he refused, to come to court. But, I mean, you could make the analogy. I mean, let's say, hypothetically, somebody wrote a book tomorrow, like Corso, let's say another Corso comes along and writes a book saying, I was a biologist and I was involved in autopsying the Roswell aliens. Well, let's say that old guy went on a tour across the US, and somebody came with valid reasons they thought why he was lying. Somebody could then make the claim, well, this book's fraud and he's peddling it across state lines and so on. You see what I mean? That is essentially all that really happened with Reich. It wasn't like he was robbing banks or anything.
Well, you got to go to court, man. I mean, if I learned anything, I almost had my life ruined because I didn't go to court for a couple of speeding tickets. You got to go to court.
Yeah, that was his downfall. But the problem was, it wasn't like he was just, like you said, I mean, a speeding ticket or one, that's bad enough. If you don't want to not go to court and then end up with even bigger problems from a smaller one. But that was one of Reich's major problems. And because it was a problem, and then he had these other things, interstate fraud charges, which isn't like just jumping a red light or whatever. That sort of really just amplified the trouble he was in.
Yeah, you just can't ignore the courts, unless, of course, you're someone like Dick Cheney. Then you can just ignore anything that comes your way. Another thing that's interesting about prominent people who have huge chunks of files missing where there should be some information on them, there was a pretty important document that went missing of Marilyn Monroe's. I mean, she apparently had a lot of secrets, and she had a diary that no one seems to be able to find now, right?
Yeah, well, Marilyn Monroe died in 1962 when she was only 36, and I guess from her movie, she kind of has this reputation as, sort of this dizzy-headed blonde and didn't really know much, and so on, which is actually totally wrong. That's sort of the person, the image that's in the public domain of her. But the reality is that she was a very clever woman. She was used to read extensively, and in 1955, she actually applied for a visa to visit what then was the Soviet Union because she was interested in it and she wanted to know what it was really like versus what people said it was like. And this actually raised eyebrows with J. Edgar Hoover, and it was one of the reasons why her file was opened, because she made this request to see if she could go to the Soviet Union. Of course, she was already a famous actress, so that would have sort of raised eyebrows even more. Mm-hmm. Now, as one of the things I talk about in the book, I mean, there are many aspects to her life and death that are sort of all filled with intrigue, but we know that at certain points, we don't even know the sort of the full years or the full story, probably never will, but she certainly had an affairs or relationships, however you want to term it, with both President Kennedy and his brother, Robert Kennedy. And one of the things that they actually didn't know she did, but she kept a lot of journals, a lot of people write journals, and she did that as well. But she also had this other one, which was became known as the Red Book. And the Red Book was contained all the stuff that the Kennedys told her and people surrounding the Kennedys who she might have met at parties and things like that. And reportedly, it was filled with sort of the sort of sensational top secrets that Kennedy essentially told her to try and lure her into the bedroom, I guess, impress her with, how would you like to hear this, And it sort of related to things like plans to invade Cuba and assassinate Castro, the relationship with the Soviet Union and how things were going with them and space missions, all sorts of stuff. And there is a story that supposedly Kennedy told Marilyn Monroe about a trip he made to an airbase somewhere in the U.S. to see a crashed spacecraft and some dead bodies. Now, this story comes from a document that didn't surface through the Freedom of Information Act, but that was given to an American author who's now dead named Milo Spiriglio. He wrote three nonfiction books on the death of Marilyn Monroe, all of which sort of supported the conspiracy theory behind the death. And he was given a document in 1995. It was purportedly a leaked CIA document of a wiretap between two particular individuals, one Dorothy Kilgallen. Dorothy Kilgallen was a famous journalist in the 1950s and 60s, who was actually the last person to interview Jack Ruby, who shot Lee Harvey Oswald. Well, this document is reportedly a wiretap transcript of a conversation between Dorothy Kilgallen and a man named Howard Rothberg, who was a mutual friend of Dorothy Kilgallen and Marilyn Monroe. And it's in this conversation that Kilgallen and Rothberg talk about this conversation or this story that Marilyn Monroe had supposedly told both of them about this crashed object and these strange bodies or dead bodies. And the story is that Marilyn Monroe, because of the way she'd been treated by the Kennedys, threatened to blow the whistle on everything and was going to go public with all these stories that Kennedy had told her that were in the Red Book. Well, of course, that never happened because she was found dead in August 1962, in the first week of August. This document is actually dated just 2 days before she died. And so that in itself is potentially suspicious. But a number of people who worked in the coroner's office and in the city, in the police department, and in the mortuary, all said that they saw this Red Book, as it was known. It was like a thick red journal. And they said it was brought into the coroner's office with a lot of her own sort of personal possessions. And but it vanished from there after about 2 days, and nobody knows what happened to it, nobody at all. Now, so in other words, that is probably the most important piece of documented evidence on Marilyn Monroe that's gone. Now, the FBI, they've released now hundreds of pages of material on her, and I think you know, a lot of most of the stuff we're going to get on her from the FBI, I think we've already got now. We certainly don't have what is rumored to exist, which is like endless reams of transcripts of conversations between her and JFK. But we do know that a lot of Hoover's files were shredded in the early 70s, his personal files. So it's possible that that's where a lot of her papers went. But there is another angle as well. The early FBI files that have been declassified, in which you can read at the vault, several of them actually have the director of the CIA copied on the documents. So the CIA should have those documents on file. But today, they cannot be found in the headquarters of the CIA. In other words, they were FBI files on Marilyn Monroe that were photocopied and forwarded to the CIA because Marilyn Monroe was looking to go to Russia. So that's another puzzling thing, is that why are these documents, which are fairly innocuous today, there's nothing sensational about them, why is it those files, which we can prove from the FBI's own records, ironically, were sent to the CIA, why can't they be found now? It almost sounds like, again, this sort of shadow agency went in and sanitized everything, and in the same way that the Air Force are baffled by their lack of Roswell records, the CIA are baffled by the fact that, yes, they admit that they should have something on Marilyn Monroe because the FBI sent it to them, but those files have gone, so who knows how many others, you know, might have been pulled 30, 40, 50 years ago. We just don't really know when it could have happened.
Yeah, it is a real shame, but it's an interesting little saga. And do you put any stock, I know you've been looking at this stuff for a long time, do you put any stock at all in the old legend that Kennedy was taken out over his plan to disclose some information on alien contacts and UFOs? Because if Marilyn Monroe was killed because she was going to disclose, I guess you could say it would make sense that if he decided he wanted to, he would go as well.
Well, yeah, I mean, I've got an entire chapter on this in the Close Encounters of the Fatal Kind book. And, I mean, it sounds to some people, even within ufology, you know, it sounds too extreme to imagine that the world's probably the two biggest conspiracies, the Kennedy assassination and UFOs, the idea that they could actually be just part of one big conspiracy, that's sort of too much for even people in the UFO subject to often take. But the fact is that the more we look into the UFO subject and the Kennedy assassination, the more we actually do find a lot of crossover tangents. I mean, to give you one example, back in 1947 in a place called Maury Island, Washington State, there was a story, June the 20th, 1947, of a squadron of UFOs seen flying over the harbor of Maury Island. and reportedly one of these UFOs exploded in the air, and sort of all this strange wreckage was sort of strewn into the harbour area and collected by a guy named Harold Dahl. Harold Dahl handed it over to a man named Fred Chrisman, who was a very shadowy, unusual, and actually quite weird character, who had a lot of ties to the intelligence community and sort of off-the-record ties as well. Well, it turns out that Fred Chrisman, who picked up this weird wreckage and shared it with the military, actually turns up in the Kennedy assassination. In fact, Jim Garrison, the district attorney of New Orleans, who was played by Kevin Costner in the JFK movie, he actually came to believe that Chrisman was one of the gunmen at the Grassy Knoll. Now, on top of that, another man who was known to Chrisman and also known to Lee Harvey Oswald was a former FBI agent named Guy Bannister, who's also played, or portrayed, I should say, in the JFK movie by Ed Asner. And Guy Bannister was somebody who extensively researched and studied the UFO subject for the FBI in the summer of 47 when the whole thing kicked off. And his UFO files have now been declassified. And at one point in July 47, he actually got a behind closed doors briefing on UFOs by the military. And we have a lot of things like this where people who were in the intel world in 47 in relation to UFOs popped up years later in the Kennedy assassination. Now, in relation to Kennedy himself, there are, as you said, rumors that he wanted to go public with what he knew about UFOs. And the story is there were two reasons. One, he felt it was important enough alone for the general public to know. He felt the idea that if there is alien life out there and we've got something, even if just a few bones and bodies and fragments of wreckage, then he felt everybody should know. But there was also, allegedly at least, another reason. He felt that at the height of the Cold War, when we'd all got nuclear weapons, the reason why there wasn't a Third World War is because neither side would dare risk launching them, because they both, despite all the bluff and bravado, both the Soviets and NATO knew that neither could defeat each other. You know, but just seconds after we'd launch our missiles or they launched theirs, mm-hmm. we would be able to detect, you know, that they were flying, and we'd just fire back and everybody would die. And so Kennedy felt if we had access to highly advanced alien technology and the Russians found out, they might be so frightened that they actually might risk a first strike. And so the story is that Kennedy wanted to share the alien technology with the Russians as well to keep a balance of power, as odd as it might sound, but it also kind of makes a degree of sense as well. And so to the people who were sort of hiding the truth, the so-called, you know, that became known as the military-industrial complex, the story is that this was just too much, and he had to go. You know, the countdown was on. Now, had Kennedy decided to go public, you know, you would rationalize that in the build-up to doing that, he would want to meet with people who were in a place and a position to share information with him so he could have a full picture. And that actually seems to be what we have. For example, the day before he was shot, Kennedy was shot on November the 22nd, 1963, in Dealey Plaza, as everybody knows. Well, the day before, he made a visit with Jackie Kennedy to Brooks Air Force Base, which is also in Texas, and he was there to open a new wing. And this particular wing was dedicated to what at the time was called space medicine. The idea was that, you know, bear in mind this was the early years of the space race, and we didn't really know how people would be affected by exposure to, for example, low gravity or no gravity or cosmic rays. You know, how would it affect your blood pressure, your pulse, your heart, your organs? So this space medicine branch was set up to research all that sort of stuff. Now, one of the people who held a senior position there was a Major General Theodore Bedwell. Well, it turns out that in the summer of 1947, Major General Bedwell actually held a major or significant medical position at Wright Field, as it is today, Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. And he would have been somebody, in the summer of 47, when he worked there, would have been a prime position to see the alien bodies when they were reportedly taken to that very base. And we know that Kennedy had a behind-closed-doors meeting with Bedwell on that day. But another person he spoke with on that same day held a significant medical position also at a place called Fort Detrick in Maryland. Now, Fort Detrick is where, even today, the government undertakes all its sort of research into biological warfare, exotic viruses, you know, essentially to ensure that if somebody, like, you know, some hostile nation tries to attack us with a deadly virus, we have some way to combat it. Now, there have been theories and stories about alien bodies taken to Fort Detrick that displayed some sort of deadly alien virus, one against which we probably wouldn't have any kind of defense at all. Well, it turns out that on the same day that Kennedy met Major General Bedwell, he also met at Brooks a man named Colonel Harold Ellingson. And Ellingson used to be in 1947, was the post surgeon and hospital commander at Fort Detrick. And so, again, he would have been somebody in a prime position to have had access to alien bodies with a viral angle. And when we see that it's sort of just 24 hours before he was shot dead, that Kennedy's meeting all these people, traveling to a base dealing with outer space fringe technologies and viruses and space technology, 24 hours later he's dead, you know. Mm-hmm. And then we have stories of Fred Chrisman and Guy Bannister involved in Dealey Plaza, and both of those guys have a UFO history going back to 47. So, you know, there are a lot of strands like that.
Yeah, it's just a weird one, because he was ruffling so many feathers of powerful people who were capable of doing something like that. And I think the UFO connections seem to be the most numerous. But I guess one big criticism I would say would just be that 24 hours is not a lot of time to plan such a high profile murder. But maybe I'm naive.
Well, no, I don't. I'd agree with you on that. But I think, I mean, if a theory has merit, I think the argument would possibly be that they knew who he was going to be speaking
right.
to, what he was going to do, and maybe they knew he was going to sort of blow the whistle on, I don't know, November the 28th or 29th. So maybe it was just a case of, well, he's going to speak to these people regardless, and we're just going to get him on the 22nd in Dealey Plaza, and his big speech on the 29th will never happen anyway. But
yeah.
I would actually agree with you when you said he ruffled a lot of feathers with a lot of people. I think actually what is probably more likely is that there were people in the UFO program who wanted him gone. There may have been people in, you know, other offices who wanted him gone. There could have been, well, we know that a lot of the people in the mafia didn't like him, and in Cuba, and there may have been vested interests in having all these people kind of on board. You know, a bunch of people wanted him gone, and sometimes, you know, countries and agencies work with the enemy for
yeah.
what they see as like a bigger, you know, goal. I mean,
right.
it's like the KGB and the US have worked together at times against China. You know, there are a number of interesting historical stories like that, because yeah. both of them sort of saw the Chinese as a threat. So, you know, it's not like we're all sort of black and white. We're never going to talk with these. We're never going to do anything with these. You know, it's not like that. The real world's never been like that.
Right. Yeah. The enemy of my enemy is my friend, they say. But
yeah.
Let's jump to some of these lesser known UFO cases from that pop up in these two books. You have a great story that took place right before the Kenneth Arnold encounter. A lot of people know that as like the jumping off point for a huge string of sightings in this country. And this thing happened before Kenneth Arnold's encounter in Brazil, probably the creepiest UFO story I've ever heard. Can you tell people about what happened there?
Yeah, well, Kenneth Arnold's sighting, June the 24th, 1947, was the one that really kicked off the whole flying saucer phenomenon. I mean, even to the extent that before Arnold's sighting, the term flying saucer didn't even exist. Just to give people a bit of background who may not know, Kenneth Arnold was a pilot, and he had this sighting over Mount Rainier in Washington State on June the 24th, 1947, of what we might call like a squadron of UFOs. And he didn't actually say they were flying saucers. What he said was, when asked by a journalist, he said they flew like saucers might if you skipped them across a body of water, sort of like an undulating motion. And then an enterprising journalist took those words and created the term flying saucer. But that doesn't mean that we didn't have sightings or reports that predated Arnold. We clearly do, even in the modern era. And one of these occurred on the night of March the 4th, 1946. And it occurred in a little Brazilian village and involved a man named João Prestes Filho. And he was 44 years old at the time. And he was a farmer in this little village. And he'd spent the day, it was a day off, he'd spent the day fishing and, you know, got a lot of food for his family and so on. And was sort of walking back to the village, and the sun was setting. It was sort of cross between dusk and darkness. And he kind of had that feeling that we all get from time to time when you think someone's watching you and you swing your head round and somebody is. You know, you're like in the line at the checkout or something, and you just get that feeling. And when you turn around, somebody's eyes are boring into you from 60 feet away or whatever. He had that feeling, but he didn't see anyone, but he couldn't shake it off that he was being watched. And well, he got back home, and he still felt it. He still could not get rid of this this feeling. And he sort of looked around the house, opened the door, looked around, and then he opened one of the windows in the house, and he was suddenly sort of bathed, is probably the best word to use, like a bright glow or a beam that was coming from some sort of object hovering high in the sky, but wasn't making any noise, and, you know, obviously hovering, it wasn't moving. So it couldn't have been a helicopter, because if there's one thing helicopters do, and certainly back then, you know, they make a hell of a lot of noise. Now, there are stories today about agencies perfecting silent helicopters, but back in 47, you know, they would have made a huge rumbling noise, but this object was totally silent. Well, he got hit by this beam, and he was able to, before he died, he was actually able to tell friends and neighbors that his body sort of started to heat up. And with hindsight, it kind of sounds like he was bathed in some sort of microwave or by some sort of microwave technology. Now, it's like when you cook food in a microwave, as everybody knows, it always says on the package, let it stand for 2 or 3 minutes. That's actually not just because the food comes out super hot. It's because microwaves cook from the inside out. So in other words, the food is actually still cooking during that period when you're taking it out of the microwave. That's why they ask you to let it stand, because you're cooking, you're eating food otherwise, where the microwaves are still cooking it. And with hindsight, as I said, it sounds like something along these lines happened to him, because although obviously the beam went away and the object went away, his skin continued to peel and burn. Almost, it began kind of like if you get a bad sunburn and your skin peels, but then he got worse and worse, and portions of his skin started to blister, and then little scabs would fall off and so on, and he was just bleeding. And his family and friends raced him to the nearest hospital. By the time they got there, his skin was literally starting to slide off, and he essentially melted away into like a pile of pretty much nothing in the hospital. Now, it sounds straight out of like a sci-fi story, but actually, and amazingly, and horrifically as well, isn't. A number of the military people who were involved, and also the doctors, have come forward and said, you know, and confirmed their involvement and the fact that, yes, this was all recorded. And one of them was a man named Arasi Gomide, who was one of the medics who was in the hospital at the time, and actually got to see Filho as he just literally kind of disintegrated. And you know, when you look at a story like this, I mean, there really doesn't seem to be any way to view it other than just downright deliberate hostility for the sake of it. You know, there doesn't seem to be any other explanation behind it at all.
Yeah, that one's pretty straightforward and pretty creepy, but it did remind me of something that's not mentioned much anymore, but I used to, when I was a kid, hear stories of spontaneous human combustion where people are found in just a pile of ash, and that was always, like, super terrifying to me. I'm like, why even put my seatbelt on when I could just explode at any minute?
Well, actually, it's funny you should bring that up. I mean, I don't mention that subject in the book, but there's actually a large FBI file on a woman named Mary Hardy Reeser, who died of SHC in the early 50s. And that file has been declassified by the FBI. I think it's about 200 pages long, or 150 pages long. And it's just sort of filled with the autopsy report, newspaper clippings, and theories where members of the public had written to the to J. Edgar Hoover and you know, come up with theories as to how it could have happened. It's sort of fascinating, almost like an early X-File, like a real X-File created by the FBI to study this woman who reportedly died of spontaneous combustion.
Yeah, wow. I don't hear much about that anymore, but yeah. There definitely were some weird stories back in the day. But,
yeah.
Another great UFO story that you have in For Nobody's Eyes Only, because it does involve some missing documents, is the UFO encounter over an Iranian base in 1976, I believe. Some interesting details to that encounter, aren't there?
Yeah, I mean, the case itself alone is important because it involves a military pilot chasing a UFO. You know, and so missing files on its own alone is profound enough. But, you know, when you've got something where almost like a dogfight, or I won't say almost, when a literal dogfight sort of occurring in the sky, then and the files go missing in that situation, that's even more profound. But this actually occurred on September the 19th, 1976, and involved the Iranian Air Force and an event that occurred in Iranian airspace. Now, this actually occurred when we were on, I won't say, you know, friendly terms with the Iranians, but certainly on cordial terms with them, to the extent that a large amount of McDonnell Douglas Phantom F-4 aircraft were sold by the U.S. to the Iranians. And so that's what the Iranians were flying back then. They were flying U.S. Phantom aircraft. And on the night of September the 19th, 1976, we have this incident where a pilot of one of these particular aircraft reported seeing a bright light in the sky, very almost sort of dazzlingly bright. Couldn't actually sort of make a shape out of it, you know, like a disc or a globe or whatever. But it clearly was no normal object because the light configuration alone told him that. So he attempted an interception of it and also armed his weapon system ready just in case he needed it. As the pilot got closer to it, what basically happened was there were stories that he was going to fire on the object. There's actually a rumor he may have fired on it, but most people take the view that he was thinking about it but actually didn't. Possibility or that scenario was supposedly taken out of his hands when the entire weapon system was disabled by whatever this object was. It seemed to have the ability to not sort of, you know, have the object just drop out the sky by wiping out its entire system, but just focusing on the weapon system. So it was just essentially rendered harmless. And there was this sort of cat and mouse game that went on in the skies for quite a while, and finally the object shot away at high speed, not interestingly enough into the skies, but reportedly to the ground. And there were stories about this object being seen lit up on the ground, and the next day the Iranian military going out, but not finding anything, or at least that's the official story. So, you know, we have this sort of bizarre, incredible case involving a dogfight between a UFO and an Iranian pilot, which ended in almost death for the pilot and certainly disabling of his entire weapon system. And of course, something like that, it's hardly surprising that official files would be put together. And we do have two documents in the public domain that have both surfaced through the Freedom of Information Act, and they're essentially summaries of the case, which I've just sort of described to you. They, through intelligence channels, U.S. intelligence agencies were able to put together a degree of the picture of what happened. However, two researchers, Barry Greenwood and Larry Fawcett, they spent a lot of time and man hours digging into the case and putting together freedom of information requests and essentially firing requests off to just about every agency under the sun for files on it. Now, although they didn't get any files other than these two, which amount to about 8 or 9 pages altogether, they did sort of attract somebody's attention. And they were contacted by people within government who said, yeah, there is more to this story, but you're not going to get the files. And they mentioned to them how supposedly one of these files was like 1.5 inches thick, like a gigantic file that clearly must have told the whole story and probably more than we'll ever know. And they tried to get this file. Nobody would own up, not necessarily just own up to having a copy, but even that it existed. But Fawcett and Greenwood sources were saying, yeah, it does exist. It's just, you're just never going to get it, that's all.
Yeah, man. And another interesting detail to that UFO encounter was that to get away from the pilots, it actually landed in the dark in the desert, I guess. But
yeah.
When I had heard that, that it went down that way, it made me tally a chalk mark in the column for those who say that these beings and crafts come from inside the Earth rather than outer space. I think that's a really interesting idea. But do you put any stock in those theories at all?
Well, I mean, people say, well, there's no way it could be, you know, like an underground race, but they're quite open to the idea of races coming from some, you know, millions of light years away.
Yeah,
so,
yeah.
You know, I mean, it's no more a stretch of believability. But yeah, I do actually think the idea of like an underground race, whether aliens living underground or some people think the UFO phenomenon is actually nothing to do with aliens, but is like an ancient terrestrial race that masquerades as aliens so they don't find out who we don't find out who they really are. There are some interesting theories that have been put forward for that scenario. For example, you know, you look at alien abductions, it seems at least on the face of it that the primary reason for abductions is sort of genetic issues where, you know, eggs, sperm, blood, DNA is taken,
mm-hmm.
and these things sort of crossbreed them, if you like, to make hybrids. And we are expected to believe, I guess, that we're genetically almost compatible with creatures born in a solar system 10, 20 light years away, which kind of sounds unlikely when you think of it like that. But if we're dealing with an ancient terrestrial race, which may not be Homo sapien like we are, but maybe like an early offshoot that gained technology, not necessarily like Cro-Magnon man or Neanderthal, but something along those lines, like a more advanced offshoot of us that lives underground and that possibly uses us, you know, in the same way that we perceive aliens are using us, but they sort of live in vast caverns and caves and, you know, they have an entire underground civilization. Yes, it does sound incredible and unlikely, but, you know, as I said, what's less likely or more likely, the idea of aliens coming from however far away and us being somehow so genetically compatible, and also the fact that in many UFO cases, you know, the entities are seen without spacesuits, without oxygen masks or their equivalent, and just walking around in our air pressure. You know, it's kind of like if you go to the bottom of the ocean and you haven't got a diver suit on, your body, you'll die, you know, because they're different in pressures. And yet these things seem perfectly functionable in our world. That, again, is another reason why we might take the view that the reason why they can operate in our atmosphere, in our oxygen levels, and in our pressure is because they're from here. A friend of mine, the late Mac Tonish, wrote a book on this called The Crypto-Terrestrials. And although it was sort of very speculative, Mac did make a lot of good points along these lines as to why the whole crypto-terrestrial theory, at the very least, should be studied at the same level as the extraterrestrial one, if, you know, for no other reason, because both of them, you know, are controversial. One, if you think about it, is really no less valid than the other.
Yeah, I mean, the point you made about compatibility of the biology, it makes you think, you know, it definitely should. The only reason that the idea that they're based here sounds more weird, I think, is just because we hear it less than the space alien theory. But this has been awesome. I mean, thanks for being one of the first guys to do one of these longer shows with me. We had a whole ton of material to talk about.
Yes, had a good time.
There's so many good stories. There'd never be enough time. But before I cut you loose, would you like to tell the people about anything more about the books or where they can keep up with you and your other work?
Yeah, well, the books we talked about tonight were For Nobody's Eyes Only and Close Encounters of the Fatal Kind. Both available on Amazon. Or you can walk into Barnes & Noble and get them off the shelves there as well. People want to contact me, they can contact me through Nick Redfern at Facebook. There are a few Nick Redferns on Facebook, but you'll find me. And I have a blog which is called World of Whatever, which is Nick Redfern Fortean, F-O-R-T-E-A-N, Nick Redfern Fortean www.blogspot.com. And I'm actually going to be talking about some of the stuff we talked about tonight at a conference called the Contact in the Desert Conference on the weekend of, I think it's August 6th, in Joshua Tree. So I'll be there for that entire weekend talking about various books and so on. And so if anybody's coming out, say hello.
Very cool. Yeah, I forgot you were going to be at Contact in the Desert. I'm actually going to be there myself, but I'm just taking my dad out for a good time so he can hear some of these crazy speakers. So I'm going to be there in kind of a, not a professional sense, but I'll stop by and say hey.
Oh, well, I often go to conferences just for a good time anyway.
Yeah, of course. So, well, very cool. Thanks again. Be careful out there digging up these documents. You got to take care of yourself. All right, man?
Thanks, man. See you later.
There we have it, people, and man, was it great to be able to do an extended two-hour show. If you enjoyed the first hour, please sign up for the two-hour show at thehiresidechatsplus.com. It's just $5 a month for 5 two-hour shows with great guests like Nick. In this week's second hour, we went on to discuss alien viruses associated with the Roswell wreckage, Aleister Crowley working for British intelligence, the huge, strange string of scientist deaths working on secret technology, the CIA's Operation Often to explore witchcraft, which might have had a presence in the death of Princess Diana. Lots of weird, great stuff we wouldn't have even had time for in the past, but now for the hardcore fans, it's there for people who want to hear it, and I've recorded 3+ shows so far, and it is a lot more work for me, but if it's going to pay the bills eventually and I'm not stressing over what the next money bomb's going to be, I think we're all happier for it. My parents feel a little bit better about where my life might be going. My girlfriend isn't quite as worried about if she fell in love and partnered up with someone who's just going to be broke all the time. And I might even be able to get some insurance in the future. Who knows? I don't want to get too ahead of myself here. But if you do like the show, please sign up. And again, if you're a musician, please check out thehiresidechats.com/music to join the archive. You can also send your music to mymusiconthc@gmail.com. I'm going to make a big archive of all the people that are willing to share their music with the show, because that is something that us independent producers and content creators have to struggle with, because the big boys have created a barrier of entry, because clearly none of us are able to afford the music that is popular, that everybody knows, and this puts a cap on the quality of a lot of independent people's productions, because we don't have the same tools, even though we have just as much drive and creative integrity. So for independent artists that are in the musical area, I figured we might be able to collaborate and you can share your music with us, the podcasters, and we can play your music as bumpers to flesh out our shows, but also to give you a little recognition as well, and propel you to a national, global stage, and it doesn't cost anything. So I think this is going to be a great system for everyone, and I am really planning to open this up to other podcasters and maybe make a big podcast musical archive that everyone can use. So either way, check it out. And next week, we have an awesome guest that several people have asked me to get, and I know you're going to love it. But I like to keep these things a surprise, so just be ready. And thanks again to those who have signed up for Plus. I can't say it enough. The few people who have are already really making a difference in my life, and I hope to make a difference in yours somehow through these shows. You are all the best. Enjoy your day. I've done my part this week. Your move, secret beyond the law, global conspiracy, cover-up, and cleanup agency that tries to keep us in the dark. Your fucking move.
The Higher Side Chat. Where it's at, with everything you need to know, from corruption to